All right, everyone. This is the penultimate talk, I think. So you guys get some kind of an award paid out in tokens to be decided in the future for your patience and perseverance. I'm echoing here, so sorry about that. Okay. So I've known Susan for quite some time.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think that's one of the few benefits of being old, in my case. But on a serious note, though, it's been a number of years of kind of coming across each other in the healthcare and now healthcare and blockchain space. And, I'm really looking forward to kind of picking your brain a little bit about where are we with blockchain in a real 101 do it today kind of thing. And then we'll go from there. But before we do that, maybe just a little bit of introduction from yourself.
Sure.
All right.
I'm actually a broken down old stockbroker. I started my career on Wall Street some 30 years ago. Career in enterprise sales, product development, spent some time on technology strategy, and then the last 10 years of that career working with banks and wealth managers, where the company I was working for provided investment processing services and technology to support funds trading, securities trading, wealth management accounts, hedge funds. I stood up an enterprise risk function in the wake of the financial crisis. And this is by way of example, an illustration, how I came to first be interested in distributed ledger blockchain, but then also double back to healthcare and some of the specific issues around medical devices I found in our company. Spiritus Partners, we founded in early 2016. I was still working in finance. We did quite a bit of market research and have actually just returned from 2 years in Scotland working with the National Health Service on a pilot with regards to the use case that we are focused on. And we'll spend some time talking about that. But we are concerned about the challenges around ensuring a medical device is safe and in good order at the point of care. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal, but it actually turns out to be a very big deal when you crack that open. Across a wide range of devices, the complexity, the innovation that's being introduced. Some of the common challenges that exist across geographies around delivery of health services, some of the underlying issues that we see here in the United States that, as you know, in England and elsewhere, are predominant, and the service delivery models that folks are looking for. So as we peel this apart, we'll start to see sort of the why and the how. And then, since this does bill as cross-border supply chain, some of the challenges that arise when you start to look at different jurisdictions and geographies and a distributed ledger implementation specifically. So I'll stop with that.
That's a good background. And there's a lot we can just pry into right from there. But let's start simple. So, an even simpler step. You mentioned medical devices. Mm-hmm. That's the world that you're in with Spiritus these days. Like, in my mind, naively thinking, that's typically things I find in a clinic or a hospital. You know, it's maybe nailed down to the floor. But I'm kind of thinking that's not really it. And maybe that's kind of a misperception. Can you explain what does a medical device look like these days?
Sure. And it's a definitional thing that has regulatory and legal consequences. It's everything from an infusion pump, a bed, a mattress, a ventilator, a robotic surgical instrument. It could be an implantable defibrillator that's software-enabled. And for that matter, software can be a medical device now under regulatory guidance. And relatedly, as we extend that out, the AI and machine learning algorithms themselves would look to be regulated under the CDRH, the Center for Device and Radiological Health. The treatment of medical devices across that full range and continuum is a challenge. It's been a challenge for a long period of time. So when you think about supply chain use cases that come to mind, pharma comes to mind, and there's a regulatory reason why we have the collaborations that we do, the projects that are occurring right now, the potential consortium that are going to arise in pharma. It's tied specifically to regulatory guidance. In the case of medical devices, there has been a challenge for a long time, and that challenge continues to grow as the volumes and complexity of devices grows. volumes in terms of sheer numbers and numbers of patients, volumes in terms of the discrete use of devices or device combination with the diagnostic and therapeutics. This proliferation is creating a challenge because it's very difficult to do two things. One is to trace in a supply chain sense, up the supply chain if you do have issues, but importantly, down into the operating life of an asset, which can extend over 10 years. An infusion pump or a bed or a ventilator, or for that matter, an implant, may have an operating life of 10 years. And this is a fundamental distinction from the pharma use case. Mm-hmm. When you crack that open and you say, what do I mean by safe and in good order at the point of care? It could be a mechanical issue. It could be something that's wrong with a syringe set. It could be guidance to staff and training to staff as to how to calibrate the alarm system. It might be a software vulnerability or patch that needs to be instituted. And the parties and players that are involved in ensuring that device is safe and good order in a maintenance and repair sense vary. Mm-hmm. They vary by health system, they vary by device type, they vary based on contractual requirements and provisions. So a clinical engineering team, biomedical technicians, medical physics staff that may be working with MRI machines or the like, they may in fact be working for the health system. On the other hand, they may be a manufacturer's representative or certified representative technician that the manufacturer allows to perform the maintenance and repair activity, the calibration. Likewise, there are third parties, servicers, that outsource relationships with the health system. And here the continuum really is, could be across almost all assets. So now let's start to introduce things like surgical instruments that require sterilization or endoscopes. Many times you'll have a central decontamination unit that's off-site, and so you're physically moving surgical instruments, the trays, off-site to decontaminate, sterilize, repackage, and bring into operating theater timely. There's a lot of tracking issues with that, not only the actual movement of the device, but the people, process, and technologies associated with getting the epidemiology, the microbiology right, and then therefore the sterile processes and decontamination right. Mm-hmm. Endoscopes oftentimes are handled within hospital. There's units within hospital, but again, it might be a third party that's actually doing that work. Yeah. So I've tried to bring out different types of devices to sort of start teasing at, wow, there's a lot of complexity here. A lot of volumes and complexity, a lot of different players, everything from mechanical issues and or parts issues, mm-hmm. Right through the most abstract machine learning algorithm, right? Yeah. All of those fit within this continuum of medical devices. And importantly, this is not orthogonal at all. There is this move from acute care to clinic to home-based care, mm-hmm. preventive care and monitoring. So. That's the rich seam that we've
That is pretty rich. I almost regret asking the question. I'm just teasing. So I took a couple of key takeaways in my mind. One is that the definition of medical device really is quite amorphous these days, okay. right? I mean, it's in my world of software. So that's the thing. And obviously, much of what's being produced right now is connected. Mm-hmm. So you could conceivably think of it as an IOMT, yes. an Internet yeah. of yeah. Medical Device, or yes. IoT, if you like. That was the first takeaway. The second takeaway was that as you were going through the different scenarios, there is supply chain everywhere, mm-hmm. right? Which we kind of know being in the healthcare and particularly the pharmaceutical industry. So as a segue, you know, we hear a lot of things about blockchain, and we're here to talk about blockchain partially. You know, and there's all these great things we can do, you know, anything from, you know, like enabling patients to monetize their data mm-hmm. and data ownership and things like this. But where do you think is the beachhead? Like, what can I do right now? Where do we start? You and I, you know, we're pumped. We leave this. You know, we're going to go to the hotel. We're going to start our new startup tonight. Right. Where do we start?
The most mundane, right? Start with the mundane. Be audacious in your vision, but pragmatic in where you step off. So literally, if I can track an infusion pump through its operating life, there are a fair amount of moving parts. And in fact, there are a lot of recalls and routine maintenance issues. And they are at the center of operational efficiency and care delivery. beds are the other thing. If you don't have beds and infusion pumps, besides nursing staff and doctors, you really aren't operating at some level. Actually, beds go missing. That's an interesting thing. Equipment gets loaned out to another facility. It goes home with a patient and otherwise. So start with something narrow as your land, and then how you expand. So in our case, we do expand to more clinical services areas.
Okay.
So all of neurology,
okay.
Right? And the right devices that are associated with that. Would you expand more comprehensively to operating theater,
okay.
ICU, general ward?
So
would you go from acute care to clinic to home? You know, you sort of make decisions about where you're doing that, but all with an eye to, I want to demonstrate out the value. In this case, the value is a consensus protocol, right? A shared registry. I'm going to put smart contracts and I'm going to put token economics to the side here for this use case and say, while I'm audacious, I'm also pragmatic. So I'm going to start with that mundane idea of, can I trace and verify not only the chain of custody, but the service history? Who did what, when, to what asset, under what auspices, with what certifications, and what are the artifacts and attestations associated with that? That could be routine maintenance and repair. It could be inspection and testing activity that's performed by an auditor, by a third party, by the Joint Commission looking at records and being able to validate those records. It could be that third party that I was referring to that's doing that work. It could be a remote patch that's introduced by way of going onto a software distributed network, a VPN, and pulling down a patch. So start around something where now you can bring the hard part. The hard part's not the technology, the hard part is, what's that minimum viable consortium? Who are the major players who would have an interest in it? And are there drivers beyond the wonder of the technology? Providing them incentives to participate in this way, and that's where we go back to medical devices. I mentioned long supply chains. It often takes months, if not years, to recognize a pattern of events, incidents, injuries, complications, and deaths. And as a manufacturer, a quality affairs, regulatory affairs specialist, to say, you know, I believe that's attributable to our device. What's more, I think it's the design, or it's this component that's been manufactured for our behalf or a third party, or it's in the sterile packaging, or it's in how it's calibrated once it's commissioned in hospital, or it has to do with guidance around battery replacement cycles or alerts or software, right? What would actually happen is that individual would have to go likely to their general counsel and say, I think I have an issue, right? And then additional information will be sought, and they will follow their regulatory obligations, and certainly from a business interest, now try to go back down the other direction. And again, I mentioned some of these assets have lives of, you know, several years, if not 10 or 12 years. How do I then identify the tail at the end and ensure that comprehensively that work has gotten done? So that's a recall management use case. It's very challenging. Two illustrations. One would be that infusion pump example that I gave you, a syringe set that may have been associated with a manufacturing window from 2016 in the fall, you know, to late 2017, then they switched over to another manufacturer. What are you capitalizing on? You're capitalizing on some things that regulators are very concerned about. First is the unique device identifier. So getting a start around a use case is, do I have some driver that's going to get an identifier against this physical asset, right? That's a good thing to have. Yeah. Are there standards out there, data standards, associated with the identification of that? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there are. GS1 is a major provider for UDI, what are known as UDIs for medical devices. They are more generally around physical products. Mm-hmm. There are standards they provide around location codes, product information. So can you move to standards? That's an important starting point. Are there standards? Is there data quality? Is there a data governance issue? And now can we have a conversation among the different parties to say, there's a reason why we're interested in improved post-market surveillance, which is the term that's used, and adverse event management. And that's where the FDA is driving. What's known as the International Medical Device Regulatory Forum, IMDRF, gets together every 6 months at locations. They are continually talking about how can we get common language around adverse events? How can we harmonize our regulations so that when a recall is issued in the United States, that information gets to the UK, gets to Australia, gets to other markets, so we don't have some situations that we've had in recent years where something is well known in the United States and less well known elsewhere, and there are unnecessary injuries and deaths. So from a regulatory standpoint, whether it's gathering real-world evidence about the efficacy and performance of medical devices as an intervention, however defined that is, or this post-market surveillance and adverse event management, there's an interest in taking what is a high level of fragmentation and silos and a lot of complexity and getting that single service history and chain of custody. So let's flip to the Internet of Medical Things and connected devices. Mm-hmm. How much of a problem is this? It's a big problem and a growing problem. A health system with, say, several hospitals, clinics, and otherwise may have in excess of 100,000 assets, of which 20-25% are connected. Probably works out to about 40 devices in bed, of which 20-25% are connected. Well, when I say connected, network connectable, actually behind that is interoperability with a pharmacy system, with an EHR, with other devices that are some fashion algorithmically tied to one another, clusters of devices, and the machine learning algorithms. So a leading health system's chief information security officer shared with the FDA's now almost 3 years ago, so the number's grown, that he had 25,000 connected devices, 25,000 connected, 6,000 unique makes, models, and versions, and over a dozen operating systems. So you can do the math on that one in the matrix and say, how do I maintain visibility and transparency and a cadence and rhythm to ensure that I have the most current versions and perform patches and upgrades? Oh, by the way, that's compounded by the fact, as I said, it may not be my clinical engineering and biomedical engineering team that's doing the work. It may be a manufacturer who's got a certified representative that's coming in and doing that work, or providing remote patch, or asking me to go to a VPN to download that patch. It may be a third party with whom I've contracted, or the manufacturer's contracted to do the work. So when you sit back and look at clinical operations, that level of complexity and that lack of transparency becomes really compelling. The other thing I'll offer is the unique makes, models, and versions. Underneath that, you have libraries and network protocols and so on that are embedded in these that may go back decades. Unfortunately, there was a significant software vulnerability identified called the Urgent 11 that has come to light just in the last week, which has hospitals across the globe scrambling to understand underneath the covers, is this embedded, is it network protocol related vulnerability? That is at some level exploitable. You have to, rate the exploitability of these things. You're not running around patching everything. But has health systems scrambling, trying to work with manufacturers. Yeah. And so there's a concept known as the software bill of materials. And can I establish and maintain, and if I'm going to do that, and this gets to the IoMT piece and where we're all going is, it might be that sensor actually that's in my home or that is on my asthma inhaler that's detecting air quality, right, and providing input back. That sensor may be, I've only cost a few cents, and it's got embedded protocol software libraries on it and potentially firmware. How do I identify and roll back and then roll forward out to that device at the point of care, right?
Yeah. Wow. So, so many things to unpackage there because that was a lot. First of all, we could have a symposium just going through this little use case of the hospital you were mentioning because so many things about that, one, are just wrong and bad, and really are symbiotic of the world that we're in, and perhaps why we're employed. At least I'm employed. But that's a conversation for a different time. Just trying to kind of interpolate what you were talking about earlier in terms of kind of the beachhead. So I kind of think of it, given that we're talking about cross-border blockchain-enabled supply chain, that really what you kind of alluded to and gave really good examples on were about compliance and transparency, right? Regulators, we're in a regulated world, whether we like it or not, and we're not the only ones. You know, it's funny because, you know, in my days at the CDC with public health and now pharma and healthcare, everybody thinks we are the most regulated industry. It turns out that is like so far not the case. You know, you look at construction, it's highly regulated, more regulated. Education, highly regulated. So it's kind of a crutch. It's used as a crutch, isn't it?
Well, I came from financial services, so
highly regulated.
Imagine conversations in the wake of the financial crisis. Right?
Exactly. But so I think this whole thing of like we're regulated, therefore you know we're bound to be inefficient and really stupid about certain things. That's just kind of a crazy thing, right?
Well, so this is in principle where I'm coming from, and I think those that have the really commanding visions are extraordinary about where this technology might apply. I am down in the nuts and bolts, you know, back in the back office, worried about those safety and quality issues from the point of view of really all parties involved, and see compliance as a tool and a mechanism that we have
no doubt
has arisen really out of the last 150 to 200 years, at least in health, okay, public health and otherwise. I like to say we live in an administrative state, whether it's the United States, the Commonwealth in the UK, and the Commonwealth countries. Foundationally, you have a legislative branch and an executive branch that really interprets and makes policy based on that legislative guidance and what that legislative intent is and executes. So it's the administrative state of the executive branch that executes. We have a judicial arm that can come be brought to bear from time to time, right? And in the United States, our preference is to emphasize property rights and the interests, therefore, of corporations versus expert testimony or expertise. And there's a tension in these areas like healthcare and life sciences, medical device regulation, farm regulation, between the expertise that's required, right, and the property rights. And that tension manifests itself really continually. And the FDA has real challenges with that, but I'm going to argue that regulators more generally do. I had the opportunity in November last year to run a workshop around regulatory experimentation for something called the Community of Federal Regulators in Canada. They come together every year and talk about how Canada can promote the interest of its citizens, safety, environment, transport, education, finance, health, but also the competitiveness of their economy and strike that right balance. So this topically was, how might we experiment with some of these enabling technologies? And my insight, and I was actually joined by a gentleman from the UK Food Safety Division, I guess I would call it a department, who had used distributed ledger to track meat and the supply chain. So he anchored on the abattoir and the provenance, literally this specific cow moved from here to here to here. It had these vaccinations and it's good to chop, to be blunt. It's good to go into the supply chain, okay? More broadly, we're bringing together, I know this would have been thematically the case, other enabling emerging technologies, right? So distributed ledger doesn't in and of itself address all the issues. In this case, I am very optimistic, at least from a compliance standpoint, whether it's inspection, testing, and audit activities done on behalf of an organization that's presented back to a regulator, or just assurance for the leadership teams and the stakeholders for the organizations that are at play, that kind of assurance and reliability of the records will help us over time relieve some of the burden from a compliance standpoint. Take regulations that were paper-based, right, and backward-looking, and provide greater level of assurance. How do I know and understand whether it's the Joint Commission here or the Care Quality Commission in the UK that work has been done, on the 150 infusion pumps that are in my inventory across three systems? How do I know, and how can I be assured? I see that as real benefit. So it is, at some level, unambitious and mundane. Yeah. And some would say you're enabling the existing players. I'm providing a level of transparency that is consistent with where the regulations are going, but is difficult to enable. And in that sense, I'm optimistic over the next 5 or 10 years that there will be a drift back the other way. Yeah. And they'll be able to relax some of these regulations based on that assurance.
Let's hope so. So we're just about out of time, but I have one more question for you, because you raised the topic a little bit earlier about how medical devices have evolved into software. Mm-hmm. So it turns out there's this thing, software as a medical device,
yes,
that the FDA is a proponent of and has had certain publications on. So tell me about that, you know, very briefly. Where do you see it going?
Well, the tide's not going to go back, that's for sure.
That's for
sure.
So
we have guidance. We've had opportunity for comment periods around what fits within the bucket or not. We've made provisions for some of the large tech firms to be able to deliver digital health in a way where they're not completely confined. It's not my lane to swim in at this point. But software as a medical device, that level of abstraction really does matter. Because you are going to ultimately draw diagnostic information and therapeutic decisions, you know, based on what that is. I would complement that by saying that a static software algorithm, right, is one thing, and the opportunity to do the efficacy, performance, safety testing, mm-hmm. You can box that very well. It's interesting, just in the last several months, the FDA has issued or its preliminary proposed framework for adaptive algorithms. Okay. Now, I look at that and I say, well, this is good, but they're at the level of, this would be good software lifecycle management practice. That's what they're pointing to. What would good practice be? And rightly so, this is more consistent with the US-based system being process-oriented rather than prescriptive. So there's going to be very important discussion, I think a three-way discussion between manufacturers, health specialists, health informatics specialists, and clinicians otherwise, and the regulators to say, what do we mean by that? How are we going to understand that? One of the areas that they're grounding down on are, what are the procedures for update? So I've trained an algorithm. How do I track the data sets that were used, the intermediate models that were used, and then the decision I made to then modify the algorithm for a broader population?
Exactly.
This is a very important area of investigation. The procedures around update was a very small part of the overall discussion. Very much of it focused on what is it you're trying to accomplish and can you demonstrate that. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming years. A very important area. And then if you double it back to the use case that we're focused on, so if in fact that updated algorithm is released into the wild, so to speak, how do I catch it on the other side? How do I catch it on the other side and know that?
And you can definitely see that being a blockchain play, because it's really a regulated information flow where you have to have compliance and transparency. Right. It's just not the way we normally think about it.
Yeah.
So that being said, we have run out of time. Should we take some questions, or are we DOA?
We're just waiting for John.
Okay, so we'll take some questions, and if there are no questions, we'll let you roam free.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Any questions from anyone? All right, well, Susan, thank you so much.
You.
As always,
yeah.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Take care.
The 2019 Converge to Accelerate Conference is brought to you by IEEE, the world's largest technical professional organization for the advancement of technology, Boehringer Ingelheim, passionately working to improve healthcare, NASCO, advancing digital health together, IPSI US, the Association of Independent Workers, for one, for all, partners in digital health, publishers of the forward-reaching blockchain in healthcare today and telehealth and medicine.